This is talking with John Hagen on 27 August 76 at Grenoble. So before we get to radio astronomy per se, can you tell me about your background at NRL before then?
Yes, well, all the dates I'm going to give you, of course, are from memory and approximate, but I think I came to NRL in 1935 with the express purpose of developing centimeter wave techniques, because we were just at that time at NRL beginning to work on radar, because the radar in the United States was originated or invented at NRL.
The Brighton 2 thing that you're referring to?
No. Now, the Brighton 2 thing was just an observation. The actual development of the techniques for detecting airplanes was started at NRL under Dr. Taylor.
Taylor, I see.
And it was in that group that I was brought in to see whether centimeter wave techniques, which were just then beginning, could be developed to the point where they could be used for radar. And so we spent some years on making magnetrons and crystal detectors and things like that, mm-hmm. to attempt to get centimeter radar going. That continued up until up through the war, but in 1939, the British came over, and we had a conference with them on radar techniques, and it was quite astounding to see how the radar development in England, which of course was a secret development, as was the radar development in NRL secret, how much there was in common.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't know about each other's
work. Until 1939.
But they were working at lower frequencies, weren't they, in general?
In general, so was NRL. NRL, the main thrust at NRL at that time was at 200 megahertz. The British also had their main radars at 40 and somewhat higher frequency.
Mm-hmm.
But the British also developed the Boot magnetron, which was the real breakthrough for centimeter radar.
Right, but you said you came to develop centimeter techniques, but in practice you didn't do too much of that in the first few years?
Oh yes, the first few years were spent on doing that. On working on developing receivers and on developing magnetrons.
I'm a little confused, but it hadn't gotten to an operational sort of point
like the
longer wavelengths.
Oh no, it hadn't. We had in the centimeter region, we worked with at that time, because of the power limitations on the transmitters.
Mm-hmm.
We worked with CW radar rather than pulse.
Right.
And demonstrated the use of CW radar against ships from the laboratory, and also from at sea, from a destroyer escort vessel, where the meter radar was first tried out.
I see. And about when is this?
Well, about 1938, thereabouts. This was before the British came over and we started the joint venture. And of course, out of the British trip to the States, then the radiation laboratory was developed under the overall committee, whose name I've now forgotten. And then the principal work on the centimeter radar was done in the radiation lab. where they had so many people.
Now let me just ask, this British delegation was in 39, of course, when England got in the war. And,
yeah.
And was the purpose essentially to see if a combined effort would
yes,
be fruitful?
Yes, they came over to, obviously there had been a high level decision at that time to cooperate with the British, mm-hmm. so they came over to find out what we knew.
Yeah.
And to see whether there could be some joint effort.
And in fact, during the war, from my impression that most of the centimeter radar was developed in the States, and the British kept to somewhat longer wavelengths. Is that right?
More or less, that's true. Yes, the British did. They developed their own centimeter radars, which they had on ships. So you can't really write it off with that generality. You'd have to say the British continued their work on centimeter radar during the
war. Okay. But now, what did you specifically work on during the war?
During the war, I worked on the on several projects. One of them was the development of a radar for use in submarines, where you couldn't use conventional antennas, of course, and so we built an antenna that was enclosed in a periscope.
I see.
And go away, dog. That radar was used, of course, by the submarines, who don't like to become exposed.
Mm-hmm.
I also worked on countermeasures for centimeter radar
mm-hmm.
during the war, and then one of the long-standing projects which we had going before the war and carried on through the war was a device for the automatic navigation of aircraft to get a ground speed indicator using centimeter techniques.
How would you differentiate the effort at the Rad Lab versus NRL? Of course, it was much larger at the Rad Lab.
It was much, much larger at the Rad Lab. And at NRL, our main thrust during the war, of course, was for radar for the Navy. And,
Was the Army developing its radar through its own lab somewhere?
Yes, the Army was doing their own up at Fort Monmouth.
I see.
And that was a quite separate effort from that going on at NRL.
During the war, did you learn about Hayes' accidental discovery of solar emission and so forth?
Yes. Somewhat late in the war. I've forgotten, of course, time doesn't mean anything now. It's hard to say, but we were aware of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you know of any experiments that might have been done in U.S. Radar labs that might never have gotten published, but that you might have heard about? And then there was Southworth thing, which I know about.
Yes.
But of any others?
No, I think those that were done were published. There's work on detecting the moon. And work on atmospheric absorption.
By Dickey, yeah. That was right at the end of the war, yeah.
Yeah.
So, given the end of the war, what direction was your own work going to take?
Given the end of the war, we had a large group of people trained in these centimeter techniques, and so we cast about for some useful scientific thing to do, and radio astronomy looked like the right thing. And we then organized a group dedicated to radio astronomy, and our first thrust was to work with the solar radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And
you were reading in Nature about the Australians and the British observations, I assume.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
So there weren't very many people involved in that kind of work at that time.
Oh, yeah,
everybody
sure.
knew everybody else.
Yeah, yeah. But was this immediately after the war now? That
you, oh, yes, yes.
Because the first publication I had that you're involved in anyway is 1948, so that's a three-year gap in there somehow.
Well, there was a, the first thing that we did and published was to observe an eclipse of the sun, which I think was done in either 1946 mm-hmm. or 47.
Yeah, I have it here. May 47 eclipse.
Yeah, right.
And it was published actually in 49 as part of a symposium on microwave astronomy, which I think the AAS organized. Or
yeah,
I'd like
well,
to hear was, about that.
The results of that were delivered at an IRSI meeting a couple of years prior to that time.
I see. But that's still May 47. Did it take 2 years to sort of get things rolling?
Yeah, it takes that much time to get things rolling, to do the experiment. Right, it takes a couple of years.
Can you tell me what was required in getting things rolling?
Well, what we had to do, of course, was to look about and to determine how much of the equipment that was available as a residue of the war
mm-hmm.
could be used and how much we had to construct. And so we instead of using radar mounts, which many people did, the group at the NRL constructed its own mounts specifically designed for solar observations.
Equatorial, therefore. Yeah.
Equatorial,
right.
Yes. The one thing about NRL, as you know since you were there, they have an excellent shop.
Right.
So we felt that we would have a much better experimental setup if we started from scratch.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well that helps to explain right away this couple years.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't slapping together, it seems, wartime stuff in order to do some measurements. You decided to really build a lot of stuff specifically for the astronomical.
That's right. And at that time, too, we also decided that we would do work at millimeter wavelengths. And so at the same time that we were developing this 10 centimeter and 3 centimeter effort in radiometers,
mm-hmm.
we were developing receivers and antennas to be used at millimeter wavelengths.
Right. 8 millimeters, I guess,
eight
is
millimeters.
The shortest that you went. Which of course is incredibly short for those days. It still is a short wavelength. But before we get up to that, that was 49 when you gave a talk at an AAS meeting about that. Could you tell me a little bit more about what you needed to do during those 2 years after the war to get things rolling? You had to get this dish built.
Right. Well, that period, you see, it was a transition period. We had a group of about 80 people to begin with when the war ended.
Right.
And out of those, we selected the group that would stay on and work at radio astronomy. And then after that, organize the laboratory, to get the equipment built and installed in the roof of the lab, all of which takes time. And then, concurrently with that, we were getting equipment ready to go for this eclipse.
But you were working 100% on this. It wasn't a matter of one project versus another one.
Well, this part of my group was working 100% on it.
Yeah. Now, you said radio astronomy group, but it wasn't called that at that time, I suspect. What was it called?
I believe it was called Centimeter Wave Research,
mm-hmm.
if I'm not mistaken. I don't know when the radio astronomy appellation was put on, but it was somewhere around 1950 it began to be called radio astronomy. Hmm. But I'm not sure of the dates.
Yeah. And can I just ask what the other... was this a branch?
There's a branch.
Right, so what the other groups in the branch were doing?
Some of them were doing things I can't tell you about.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. A group was still working on this ground speed indicator, which used centimeter and millimeter frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
But a good deal of the work that was being done by the rest of the group was classified, and unfortunately I don't always remember what was and what wasn't,
yeah.
So I better just not
okay.
talk about it.
Now can you tell me who was in the radio astronomy group?
And I hope I don't forget someone.
You can check the transcript and think about it later.
Yeah. Well, Haddock and Mayer, Sloanaker, McCullough, a fellow named Cease.
Decker, I see here.
Decker.
Shulkin, who's here?
Shulkin.
McLean, was he there?
McLean. This was immediately after the war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Shulkin was not there immediately after the war. I've forgotten when he came into the group. That was a little bit later, but it was soon after the war. Gibson.
Oh, yes.
Gibson. McEwen. I think those were
okay.
the principal people in that group.
And another question that comes to mind is, why was the Navy willing to support this sort of research? What was their interest in it?
Well, NRL, from the beginning, was always interested in promoting basic scientific work. The certain portion of the NRL budget was set aside for basic scientific work that, of course, that might possibly sometime benefit the Navy, but there was no pressure to show a direct,
yeah.
direct use.
And this came under that heading, I see.
Yes, yeah. And we were able to convince them that radio astronomy was just a good effort
mm-hmm.
to get into, principally because it led to the development of useful radio techniques that would not otherwise have been that early developed.
Yeah, can you name a couple of examples?
Well, yes, antennas. The whole matter of antennas for use at very short wavelengths really developed out of radio astronomy.
I see.
The first big antenna that was useful at centimeter and millimeter wavelengths was that 50-foot bridge
right.
that we built at NRL. So that what was learned there made it much easier, not only there, but of course, don't misunderstand me, in other radio installations, made it much easier for the communication satellite people,
mm-hmm.
for example, to
yeah.
get on the big antennas. So, and then the development of receiver techniques is perhaps the most important part. That in the radio astronomy, you must deal with the most sensitive and most stable receivers,
mm-hmm.
and so the thrust for the development of very stable and very sensitive receivers in those days was pretty nearly all from radio astronomy.
I see. There wasn't really a commercial need for them.
No commercial need at all.
As has developed since.
Right.
That's an interesting comment.
Another point is in the matter of precise calibration. Now, I mentioned a fellow named Cease in this list of people
mm-hmm.
who worked with. Of course, we understood that we had to have very accurate measurements of flux of sources, and initially we used essentially thermometers and oven techniques, or so-called hot loads,
mm-hmm.
to calibrate our receivers. But at about that time, which is in the late 40s, use of discharge tubes was mm-hmm. introduced, and Cease, I think, made the first precise calibration of a discharge tube.
I see.
Those things are used all over.
Yeah, sure.
So that there again, that's another one of the reasons why it was worth the Navy's while to back radio astronomy.
Well, this is a very interesting list. Can you think of any other examples? I was just wondering if interferometry, of course, NRL didn't get into interferometry until really VLBI in the 60s, I don't think. Is that true?
No. We had a Michelson interferometer operating operating in the laboratory in 1936 at 10 centimeters. We never made a great use of it. One of the things that we did do, and we did that internally and never did publish it, was to measure the dielectric constant of materials, some materials that we were interested in.
I see. This is before the war now, you're
This
talking.
Is yeah. before the war, when all of this stuff was classified.
But I was thinking of radio astronomy.
In radio astronomy, no.
You didn't get into
the We did not use an
Which is actually sort of a interesting contrast with virtually every other radio astronomy group in the 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Was this because you were concentrating in the higher frequencies where resolution wasn't such a problem?
Well, two reasons. One, we were concentrating entirely in the higher frequencies. We didn't have, until we started work on the hydrogen line, we didn't have anything lower in frequency than 3,000 megahertz. The other reason why we didn't do interferometry was geographic. Our equipment was all on the roof of a building at NRL, and had we gone into interferometry, we would have had to go out and find land somewhere where we could build the interferometers, and that there was more of a problem with that than it looked to be worth. And furthermore, at that time there was not the great push to develop interferometry techniques at centimeter wavelengths.
Why?
Well, because the facilities for making very large antennas was not yet with us. It wasn't until 1950 or so that we got this 50-foot dish, and it's only with the very large antennas that you can see the weaker sources where you need the high resolution.
I see what you're saying.
That statement is not entirely correct.
Yeah.
There are some things on the site where interferometer techniques would have been useful, and we could have, of course, done that with the antennas we had available. But we did.
Well, one can't do everything. I mean.
No, you can't. That's right.
Let's go back to the first experiment that was published. Anyway, is this the first one you did? In fact, there's a report of a burst in July '48 in Phys Rev by Chopin, Haddock, Decker, and Mayer, and Hagen. At 9,500 megahertz with using a 10-foot dish. Was this your first real thing?
I, possibly that's right, yes.
When you got this system working, what did you do with it? Just monitor the sun and this burst happened to come along? Or?
Well, that that equipment we kept in daily operation so that we were able to amass data on the flux of the sun and analyze that as a function of the sunspot activity.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, of course, not so much was known about the origin of the enhanced solar radiation. And this was part of the early work on demonstrating that the solar radiation, the excess solar radiation, is a close function or has a very close relationship to the solar activity as evidenced by sunspots.
Right. Did you know about the work of Covington that was going on?
I'm not sure when we first became aware of what Covington was doing. I can't give you the exact date. About that time, mm-hmm. somewhere in there.
Now, what about this symposium on microwave astronomy? It's one of the earliest such meetings, I think. Where and when was this held?
Is this the one was held under the National Academy? Was held in Washington?
I'm not sure. I think it was, a few papers were published in the Astronomical Journal. Undoubtedly it says there where and when. That was in 49. I'm not sure of the meeting.
Well, there was a separate publication on that thing.
Oh, no, you're thinking of the 54 meeting that was in JGR.
Was it that way?
Yeah. The one where virtually all U.S. radio astronomers got together.
Yes.
Yeah, that's 54. This was one that, it's an AJ in 49, the Symposium on Microwave Astronomy. I think it was part of a AAAS meeting.
Well, my memory's gone. I don't recall that. I'd have to go back and look at the journal.
And you had a paper on the
Lindbergh,
on your eclipse, May 47 eclipse.
Yeah. No, I'll have to go. Okay. I'd have to go back and look at the
journal. Well, can you tell me about this eclipse?
Yeah. Well, the eclipse is a lot of fun. We had a fairly long series of eclipses that we went to and observed at centimeter and millimeter wavelengths. The principal purpose for the eclipse observations later on was to demonstrate the truth of the existence of Lindbright.
Right.
But in this first eclipse, we had two. We didn't have a preconceived notion. We hadn't worked up the theory by that time. We had no real prior knowledge of limb brightening,
mm-hmm.
but we were aware of the need to correlate the excess flux with regions on the sun, and so we went to that eclipse really to investigate whether the excess radiation was confined to small areas and whether they would be eclipsed.
Mm-hmm.
And that in fact was demonstrated.
In particular, these short frequencies, short wavelengths.
Yes, yes.
This had been demonstrated, the long wavelengths, yes. I think, by that time. Royal and Australians had found that spots were smaller than the sun and the radio as well.
Possibly. I'd have to check the references.
Yeah.
The other thing, of course, that came out of this was an indication that it was limb brightening.
Now, when you say you hadn't worked out the theory, were you aware that, for instance, Martin had a paper in Nature in which he, at several different frequencies, showed how limb brightening sets in as you go to higher frequencies, on his theory anyway?
Well,
that was 46.
I was aware of Martin's work, yes. Yeah.
But that was just the results. He didn't go through the whole theory in the paper. It's a Nature mm-hmm. thing. I'm just wondering if your observations were in response to that, essentially.
Not specifically in response to that, no. Again, I am not too clear in my memory about events at that time in the particular sequence of events.
Right.
We were up to do that.
Well, it's 30 years.
We were aware of Martin's effort, and that combined with the work of Cowling in England really led to the theoretical work that was done by Denise and by me. Denise did, put his effort mainly on the corona, the outer part of the sun, and I put emphasis on the chromosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But the two things fitted together quite well, and my part of the work, at least, leaned heavily on the work of Cowling and on the work of Martin.
Now, was Cowling using radio data?
No. Cowling was purely theoretical.
Right,
the theory of diffusion, the theory of impact, which led to the which is a basic part of this brimstone and radiation.
So he wasn't working on the sun.
No,
the name didn't ring a bell. Well, that's right. Finally, you published this in 1951 in APJ.
That's right. Right.
And I think also that this is your PhD thesis at Georgetown, am I remembering correctly?
That was, that's right.
Did you go take time off to become a student, or did you just do it all part-time?
I did it part-time and at night.
I see.
Yes.
This is rather interesting because this is one of the earliest PhDs in astronomy, radio astronomy, I think.
I'm told it is the earliest.
I see. Well, I'm not sure I can think of a counterexample now that you bring it up.
I'd be interested if you could. Menzel, who was on my committee, thinks it's the first.
Okay. I just talked to him a couple days ago, by the way. But what I wanted to ask was, this probably meant that you took a lot of courses in classical astronomy and so forth. And
well, yeah, you see, I started out in physics and astronomy, and then the Depression came along, and then the war. The Depression led me to NRL, and then I stayed on when the war came on, and I had previously done graduate work at Yale, so that I didn't have too much to finish off at the graduate work I did at Yale was in physics, but I didn't have too much to finish off at Georgetown.
I see.
PhD. I did have quite a bit of coursework.
When you say astronomy, as an undergraduate, you took a number of astronomy courses?
Yes, and at that time, my intention was to go into astronomy.
Oh, really?
After I got into graduate school. But I really entered graduate school in physics.
Well, this explains a little bit more why you were eager to latch on to this new radio astronomy.
Oh, yes.
Combine two of your
that's right.
real interests,
that's
right. Yeah.
Get me back on the track.
Right. Mm-hmm. May I ask what undergraduate school you were at?
Boston University.
Oh, and yes.
And then I did a master's degree at Wesleyan, working on the properties of quartz using radio techniques, so looking at the decay of oscillations and quartz crystals.
I see. Well, to go back to your thesis work on the theory of the solar radiation and a radiative transfer, as we call it now anyway, and so forth, there was similar work going on, I think, by Smerd and so forth, but this was probably, you weren't aware of this at the time. Were you sort of working, this was all brand new as you worked on it? Or?
It was brand new, and what's his name? Pazzi visited the laboratory at one time just as I was about ready to publish this, put the thesis into Georgetown. This was before I condensed it for publication. Mm-hmm. And I told him at that time of the contents of the theory and what it led to. And subsequent to that time, Piddington down in Australia published a paper, which I think actually was published before my paper, dealing with the same topic, but in a much more general way.
Mm-hmm.
As he just assumed an exponential decay in pressure, which is easy to do. The Australians were working at that time, the Smerd, and I've forgotten.
Westfold was he?
Westfold, and there was another fellow. But Smerd and Westfold in particular had been working in this area, but their interest was in the outer part of the sun's atmosphere.
Because they were at lower frequencies, basically.
Yes, exactly. And they did some very excellent work. The work that they did on synchrotron radiation is still, I think, as good as
one. On synchrotron, you say?
Yes.
But that would not be the quiet corona then.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No.
Right. But you weren't dealing with bursts and such.
No. I was dealing with the quiet sun.
Right.
And the process that I dealt with specifically with Bremsstrahlung radiation.
Right. I noticed also in 49 that you gave an AAS talk about the microwave observations of the sun and what brightness temperatures it implied at the various frequencies, going from 6,700 to 2 million and so forth. But the important thing is that one thing I see here is that you're talking at a AAS meeting. In other words, you're talking with the astronomers.
Mm-hmm.
And does this come out of the fact that you were a student at Georgetown and really feeling to be a part of the astronomical community as opposed to going to an IRE meeting? And
yeah. The important thing here is that at this period in time, radio astronomy was a nasty word in the astronomical community. And
why was this?
Astronomers are, don't quote me on this, they're a peculiar breed of people. They resist what is new. They weren't ready to accept the fact that radio astronomy was telling them things that they couldn't find out by any other means.
Mm-hmm.
This is the American Astronomical Society. This is not true so much in Europe, nor was it true so much in Australia. But in the United States, this is true. One well-known American astronomer, whose name I won't give you, said one time when some work was being considered here on developing equipment for observation of the hydrogen line.
Being considered where?
In the United States.
Yeah.
You don't need to do that. Why did the Dutch get it all done? So, getting back to your question, the point is I felt that what we were doing in radio astronomy was astronomy, and that therefore it ought to be reported to the American Astronomical mm-hmm. Society. That's why I put the paper to you.
Right. But that was really an exception, I think.
At that time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And for quite a while, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe I should be careful.
Well, I think it's something that just gradually came on. Most of the time, the people in the American Astronomical Society didn't know what you were talking about. It just didn't know.
Yeah.
But they gradually became more receptive.
And what you were saying is not, you don't mind so much that they don't know what you're talking about, but that they really didn't care to make the effort either.
At that time.
Yeah. Well, can you tell me a little bit about the model that you worked out for your thesis work and so forth? What light it shed as opposed to what was known before?
Well, what it, you know, what, see, what, and one of the big problems in working with the sun is that optically you cut off at a height of about 1-2,000 kilometers. Above that, the optical depth is so small that you observations are just impossible.
Right.
And so the principal information about the sun gained through optical observations at that time cut off at about 1,000 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
What I did was to take the radio, not everybody's radio observations, none of my own, and put them together to show the variation in flux or in effective temperature of the sun as a function of frequency, and then set about using the Bremsstrahlen radiation process as the efficient radiation process to
mm-hmm.
to put together an atmosphere that would predict the observed flux as a function of wavelength. And it was questionable in the beginning whether this has any uniqueness to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think by testing the model, I satisfied myself that it is unique. There is no, there are not 100 different ways you can put an atmosphere together and still satisfy this criterion you set out to satisfy. This also explains our great interest in eclipses, because the eclipse measurement gives you a means of establishing height. And once you put that measurement in, then the whole question of uniqueness falls
right.
To rest. You know that if your heights are right, then everything else is okay.
Right.
So the outcome of this was a model of the sun's atmosphere giving temperature as a function of height and electron density as a function of height. And that, there have been other models since then. I still, up until very recently, use that same model, and it works quite well. I am on the verge of publishing a much more up-to-date version of this, which shows a unique feature, but that's not a part of this story.
Yeah.
But it's based on the same assumptions, but on much better observations now of the flux after these 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, but what you're saying is that after 25 years, this model basically still holds.
It still holds, except for the lower part of it, where there's a problem here. The radio evidence tends to show that the temperature in the sun's atmosphere falls very steeply as you go in the transition region between the corona and the chromosphere. The solar observations from way back when, back in the 30s, and then again some made in the 40s, show that perhaps without question that somewhere, and the height is not awfully sure, somewhere at 2,000, 3,000 kilometers above the limb,
mm-hmm.
The temperature has to be on the order of, well, depending on the person you talk with and the